Welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Academy, brought to you by the Plan B Network and Bitbox. I'm Knut Svanholm. This is the course on Sovereignty Through Mathematics, my first book. And I'm here, as always, with Luke DeWolf. Good morning, Luke. How are you today?
Good morning, Knut. I'm excellent. I'm excited to cover this chapter on a new form of life. How are you today?
All good. We're doing all the things, preparing for all the conferences that are coming up and stuff. The new version of Praxeology is just out on Amazon and BitcoinInfinity.com. So excited for that. I think it's our most ambitious book yet, I'd say. So excited for that and excited to keep on doing the Academy. I love it all.
Yes, absolutely. And the Praxeology, for those who aren't aware, is the bonus addition to the Mithril Adamantium membership. Basically, we're including the Praxeology course for free in that membership. So this is going to be the fifth course of the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. We're on course number one with Sovereignty Through Mathematics and Praxeology. Well, we'll get there eventually, but it's going to take a little while. But we're having a lot of fun, and hopefully you are too. So I'm ready to just dive in. I think, is there anything else to mention before we start?
No, I'm just saying that this is the last but one chapter, I think. So after this book is done, we'll have playlists available and stuff. So you can go back to this and go through all the videos. And this is the Academy is will become this great library of both videos and books. And I love doing it. So let's hop in and go to our Geyser fund, geyser.fund/project/infinity, to know more about how you can participate in these things and have a monthly call with me and Luke and, comment and ask questions about each chapter. It's well worth it. And as Luke said, you'll get the entire book bundled, signed books and t-shirts and whatnot. So yeah, everything is there.
Perfect. And with that, let's get started. A new form of life. It's not easy to define the properties that would deem an entity a new form of life. There's no consensus among scientists or nations regarding the definition of what a life form is. This is one of the main hurdles when it comes to defining artificial or synthetic life. How does one know when life is being created if there's no clear definition of what life actually is? One popular definition of life is that a living organism is an open system that maintains homeostasis, is composed of cells, has a life cycle, undergoes metabolism, can grow, adapt to its environment, respond to stimuli, reproduce, and evolve. Could Bitcoin fit into this description? In order to find out, we need to dissect both this definition of life and the basic properties of the Bitcoin network. Bitcoin is quite clearly an open system, but what does it mean for an organism to maintain homeostasis? Homeostasis is the tendency towards a relatively stable equilibrium between interdependent elements, especially, but not limited to, as maintained by physiological processes. The first part of that sentence perfectly describes what Bitcoin does. The equilibrium is the consensus between the nodes, which act as interdependent elements. One could even argue that they actually are maintained by physiological processes, since each node's decisions are ultimately made by human brains and not software. But for now, we'll examine Bitcoin as a life form from a non-meta argument perspective. The next part of the definition is that life is made up of cells, which the Bitcoin network also arguably is, especially if you count nodes as cells. Okay, interesting chapter, Knut. What are you getting at here with all this life cycle stuff?
Yeah, this is one of those chapters that is sort of an embryo for a bigger chapter in a later book. And we go through this in a chapter in The Inverse of Clown World called We Are All Satoshis, how the node is actually the person and not the hardware and the software. But this is sort of the foundations for that, and alluding to here, what was the word? Non-meta argument perspective, that you can view Bitcoin as a life form even without admitting that each technical component is actually a person. There's a person behind every node.
Yeah, interesting idea. I think the entire chapter is quite the interesting take. Definitely one of the more out there chapters for this book, but I think the the important messaging here is something like that Bitcoin is really this new system, and there's a lot of parallels to I suppose the science of decentralized computing. Like, what does it mean to have a decentralized computing network over the internet? And yeah, lots of interesting stuff here. What gave you this idea originally, do you think?
I don't remember where I got the idea from. Other people have written about the similar things, like Brandon Quidham, for instance, who wrote an excellent article called Bitcoin is Mycelium way back. These two are written around the same time. I don't remember if I read that before I wrote this, but I knew there were other things written about Bitcoin being some kind of life form when this book came out. So as most of us authors or writers writing about Bitcoin do, we sort of funnel ideas from here and there and give our own takes on it. But influences come from everywhere. And this, I just wanted to explore the idea. So I looked up this definition of life and started from there and tried to explain Bitcoin from that perspective. Even though it's mostly a mental gymnastics, if you want, like brain, mental gymnastics in the sense that it's a brain exercise. I still think it's interesting to see things from this perspective, Bitcoin being this great cardiovascular system of value between human beings.
Excellent. And maybe we should continue with the exploration, get into it a little more deeper.
Absolutely.
A life cycle is defined as a series of changes in form that an organism undergoes, returning to the starting state, according to Wikipedia. The life cycle of the Bitcoin network is still unclear, but it seems unlikely that it will ever return to its starting state. What is more likely is that while we have witnessed its birth, it is highly unlikely that any human alive today will outlive the network, so we won't have any way of knowing. This is not unheard of in nature either, however. A species of fungi called Armillaria ostoyai, or the humongous fungus, in the Blue Mountains of Oregon, is one of the largest and oldest organisms ever known to man. This mushroom network is estimated to be between 2,500 and 8,500 years old, based on its current growth rate. No one knows what its life cycle looks like in perfect detail. Okay, so just a comment here, I guess, about that Bitcoin might not be satisfying one of the definitions of life, but it's parallel to like a fungus, something like that.
Yeah, it may have life, but it's unclear if it has death. That's sort of the point of this. I guess at some point there will only be one sat left because of the unforgiving nature of the arrow of time. However, that is, if Bitcoin just keeps on functioning the way it does, that will take a long time for sure.
Yes, practically irrelevant to anyone who is alive today, basically. It's on the same level as heat death of the universe type stuff, would you say?
Not quite, but close. I mean, it's still a smaller time scale than that. That's the autist answer, I guess, but the heat death of the universe is quite far away in time-wise, probably a lot later than whenever Bitcoin dies. Anyway, the point of this is this specific paragraph is this fungi metaphor here, that there are organisms that can get like insanely old, and Bitcoin is probably one of those. Hopefully one of those.
Hopefully, yeah. All right, moving on. The three main purposes of metabolism in a living body are the conversion of food to energy to run cellular processes, the conversion of food into bodily building blocks, and the elimination of nitrogenous wastes. Bitcoin's metabolism works in a similar manner. Bitcoin feeds on electricity, and its cellular processes are its transactions. Its body has its own building blocks, literal blocks, that are added to its body, the blockchain, roughly every 10 minutes. Malicious blocks are considered waste and are thus eliminated by the system. Bitcoin grows and adapts to its environment organically, exemplified lately by the development of the Lightning Network and other Layer 2 scaling solutions. It responds to external stimuli by showing a more and more ironclad resistance to change while still responding well to sufficiently clever improvement proposals. Like the Armillaria ostoiae, Bitcoin grows rather than reproduces, and it evolves over time by adopting good ideas and rejecting bad ones. Okay, it's some interesting stuff here, including, I think, a parallel between effectively the people who work on Bitcoin and sells something like that. It's sort of like acting like the cells of Bitcoin are the people that do stuff that make the improvements, something like that.
Yeah, or even the transactions. I think the people using Bitcoin as its cells, sort of like the individual Bitcoiner is the cell of the network. Here, if this was written in after February 2023, I might have added something about cancer tumors in these cells in the form of JPEGs and other arbitrary data that can infect the cell from within, and like that the organism will have to figure out a way to survive this cancer and remove the tumors from itself, and that might not be an easy thing to do. However, it is crucial for the long-term survival of this mycelium network.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think this is definitely one of the strongest parts of this comparison. And it really comes down to that there are just so many people doing so many things on or to Bitcoin. And I think you're right. Ultimately, the transactions is the way that the organism itself grows up. It's what shows that people are actually using the network, adopting it as money. But I think part of my other point is that when people are doing development on Bitcoin and actually making changes that might eventually lead to some kind of actual change, like if we're using the fungi metaphor, like splitting off a different branch of the fungus in a hard fork type sense, or I don't know what a soft fork exactly would look like, but yeah, change is being made, similar to how the cells in the body can make changes. Like if you stress your body by lifting heavy weights or something, your body responds and does stuff a little differently. And I think that's how Bitcoin reacts to sort of external stimuli, like the way people are using Bitcoin, and sometimes people have to make adjustments, fix bugs, stuff like that.
Yeah, and there are, just like in real life and in evolution, like on a timeline, there are specific, very specific points in time where, like, humanity had a common ancestor with the Neanderthals, for instance, and we branched off, we hard forked at a very specific point in time. There must have been a specific set of parents and two specific set of children that forked off. And the one of the forks didn't make it. Neanderthals are not around anymore, and humans are. And it's very similar to like the Bitcoin Cash hard fork in Bitcoin. We had a common ancestor, and we branched off, and the less evolutionary and advantageous fork just didn't make it, and the Bitcoin Cash isn't worth shit anymore. So. I mean, another thing about this entire chapter is that you can use this metaphor in many different ways. I just chose to use like the Bitcoiners as cells and building blocks being like the blockchain being its body. You could also view the blockchain and the blocks as literal shit, like the fecal matter of the network, that it's not important once the block is, like, historic. The block only matters in the present. But like all metaphors around Bitcoin, Bitcoin is this, Bitcoin is that, they're all flawed, and they all have some grain of truth to them. But it's important to remember that none of the metaphors is 100% accurate. Like a Bitcoin wallet is not really a wallet, more of a keychain, but something between the two. A blockchain is not really a chain of blocks. It's more like a spreadsheet that adds data. However, I love the exercise of just thinking of Bitcoin in metaphors and trying to explain it through different lenses, because I think with every new metaphor, you reach another set of your audience to orange pill, if you will. So, yeah.
I definitely agree with that. And let's read one more short paragraph here before making a couple more points along this specific line. The notion of Bitcoin as a life form may sound far-fetched and even a bit silly, even though a lot of its properties fit the bill. What we do know about it is that it is very unlikely to go away or stop functioning in the foreseeable future. Whether or not Bitcoin is alive is up for debate, but it can't be killed, and that ought to mean something. We should study it carefully and try to be as unbiased and humble as possible when drawing conclusions about it. I have some thoughts about this, but what do you think? Would you change anything about this paragraph in the current era?
No, I immediately come to think about something Michael Dunworth said in Sydney a couple of months back. And that is, like, Bitcoin is the first thing that humans have built that humans cannot destroy. And I just love that framing, like, because it's truly unique in that particular sense. Yeah, here we may go into that Bitcoin actually could be killed if we don't survive this latest attack or whatever. I still think there's a high likelihood that it can't be killed. So what were your thoughts?
Well, basically along that exact line, it's not necessarily about Bitcoin being killed or not. I think Bitcoin, the network, Bitcoin, the technology, that might actually be the thing that can't be killed. Because as long as people are using it, right, then that's okay, good. That thing isn't dying, right? But I think the thing to be a warning about, maybe the metaphor of these monkey JPEGs and all this DeFi stuff and whatever else that people are trying to throw into Bitcoin, maybe it's not necessarily cancer exactly as the right thing, but maybe more like a genetic splicing, turning Bitcoin into something that it isn't or something that it wasn't intended to be originally, right? Bitcoin as money is absolutely under threat here in probably a low chance, but if Bitcoin stops being used as money, you can debate whether that means the thing is dead or not. To me, it would be dead if Bitcoin gets completely captured and doesn't actually end up being used as money anymore. It's just a piece of technology being used to facilitate scammers and government crap, then what is Bitcoin?
I mean, this is a great way, a great question. So imagine if during the Bitcoin Cash hard fork that the quote unquote good fork would have been the minority fork and the bad fork would have been the bigger one, which might be the case if we hard fork in the future and you get Bitcoin database and Bitcoin money, right? And right now, Bitcoin database, according to how many nodes, like we're 10.5% Bitcoin knots nodes. So let's say that the Bitcoin database is 10 times bigger and all the, you know, shitcoiners and, you know, exposure to Bitcoin people win this race and they keep on using this this type of Bitcoin. That might go on for like 100 years, that being dominant, but Bitcoin money could still exist in the background. And it's only when this Bitcoin database chain is so clogged that it's not decentralized by any stretch of the imagination anymore that people will wake up to, holy shit, this smaller fork was actually the real deal. And there is a scenario where we fork off and then come back in like 400 years from now and become the dominant fork anyway. So like, it doesn't necessarily mean that Bitcoin dies if it forks off and one of the forks stays dominant for X amount of time. That doesn't mean it was killed. I mean, to the Bitcoin Cash people, that is still the original Bitcoin. They think that they are on the correct network. And I don't believe that it will ever happen that Bitcoin Cash becomes more valuable than Bitcoin normal, simply because of the fact that Bitcoin Cash is not decentralized. It has this. It doesn't have limited block space, and it has set a precedent for not having limited block space, meaning that this chain will, if used, will be clogged with shit, and it will be impossible to run a node because it will be very costly to do so, and therefore this chain will be controlled by miners and not nodes, so it's not Bitcoin. However, a fork where we are, where what I consider to be normal Bitcoin, or what we consider to be normal Bitcoin, like Bitcoin being used as money and not as monkey JPEG storage, that may fork off, be smaller, but come back in 400 years from now. We don't know.
No, that's a great metaphor, though, and a great scenario. And I think, yeah, answers the question a little bit of whether Bitcoin can be killed. And you're right. I think Bitcoin can't be killed as long as there are people still using it. And yeah, hopefully we don't get to a point where there has to be a hard fork to save Bitcoin. And there's a risk of being the smaller chain, but the point stands. I think that's very good.
No, it's sort of like if you have an ant colony in your garden, like with several ant colonies on your grounds or whatever. There's a forest with a lot of ant colonies, and then there's an ant colony exterminator trying to exterminate all the ant colonies, and he succeeds. He thinks, because he destroys 99% of them. But as long as there's just one queen left, this whole thing may blossom again one day and like turn into this big thing again. So like you can hurt Bitcoin, but that doesn't necessarily mean you killed it. The idea is still there.
Very good. Shall we continue?
Absolutely.
Speaking of fungi, one of the most important aspects of money is its fungibility. Fungibility goes hand in hand with privacy and censorship resistance. If certain Bitcoin addresses were to end up on a government's blacklist, they'd end up becoming less valuable than their not yet blacklisted neighbors. Look at what happened to the Indian rupee bills that were banned overnight by the Indian government in late 2017 in order to fight corruption. They're still in use, but only worth about 70% of the value they held when they were considered legal tender. If Bitcoin transactions can't be private, they won't be fungible. This would reduce Bitcoin's monetary capability. We're at a point in history where Bitcoin transactions can be completely private, but only a select few people know how to ensure that they really are. This is arguably Bitcoin's greatest flaw and a very real hurdle on the way to mainstream adoption. Okay, some interesting stuff here. What do you think about this paragraph now?
Oh, yeah, this is super interesting. This, like, it's just scratching the surface of many much bigger topics, like coin joins and the privacy of the Lightning Network and all sorts of stuff. Fungibility is interesting because what constitutes a fungible good is in the eye of the beholder. So, like, it's entirely subjective. Like, it's just like how what constitutes a homogeneous good is entirely subjective too. One person may enjoy apples over oranges, but put to a third person, it might all be in the category of fruit, and then fruit is the homogeneous good. So if the more people that act as if KYC Bitcoins and non-KYC seed Bitcoins are the same thing, and the better off the network is. The more people treat some sats differently than others and believe false narratives, such as the rare sat, like there is no such thing as a rare sat. Every sat is created equal. Not all men are created equal, but all sats are. There is no such thing as a rare sat. So I am a proponent of, like, Bitcoiners should treat their sats equal. Even though it might be clever to have a non-KYC stack and a KYC stack if you want to use them for different purposes, the SAT itself should, like, have the same value to you. You should view it as the same thing. I think this is good for the entire network. And the more coins that are coin joined and the more coins that are harder to trace, the better off the network is, because it's really harder for legislators to differentiate between the two. And having said all this, like, already in its normal state, Bitcoin is entirely anonymous. People say pseudonymous, but I really don't think it is, because you cannot prove that another person does not own all the Bitcoin ever. It is possible for everyone to be aware of the same information, and a Bitcoin private key is just information. So you can't really prove that someone does not own a Bitcoin. Theoretically, everyone on Earth could own all the Bitcoin and know all the private keys. The likelihood that they do is low, but there is no way to prove that they don't. So we're trying to prove a negative by associating certain Bitcoin with certain people. You only own them in the sense that you have the access to the key that unlocks them, so you can move them on the network. But it's not really ownership, and there is so much here.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the interesting thing is, I think the coin joining and privacy on Bitcoin on chain thing was a bit bigger a couple of years ago here. Certainly it was more in the news when, for example, Samurai and Wasabi were both essentially shutting down. Wasabi is still going on, albeit not coordinated by the wallet itself. So you have to go find your coordinators and all this. And so I think you do have a lower usage rate, which isn't all that positive. But I really like your point that Bitcoin basically is private by default. It's private unless you dox that you have this address, basically. And it's private to everyone except the people who know about the transaction, right? The two people involved in the transaction, if I'm sending you a Bitcoin transaction, Knut, you'll know the address that I sent it from was mine, and I'll know the address you gave me is yours at that time, period. And so if you do some silly things like start sending the Bitcoin that I gave you to, you know, a porn site or whatever, or to a known cocaine dealer or something like that, I would know that you're doing some fun things, and maybe I would want to hang out with you that evening. But the main thing is you have to get yourself doxed. You have to intentionally leak out that I have this address, right? And there are so many ways to minimize that these days. And simply by sending your Bitcoin from one address to another is usually enough to pretty much break all linkages. If you do it even two or three times, maybe, okay, you'd be out your transaction fees, but really no one would have any idea what's going on there. And there's debates about kind of reporting structures with Bitcoin and all this. And like, I know that if I purchase Bitcoin from an exchange and then send it to an address, like, okay, that is known. That is 100% known, as far as I'm concerned, that someone has that I have this Bitcoin, and if I'm sending it around or whatever, I'm paying for stuff, this and that, like that can be traced. That is known. But it's not the case with if you're receiving Bitcoin for your goods and services, or if you're buying Bitcoin for cash from a buddy, something like that. So, yeah, Bitcoin privacy is a really complicated topic, and I'm not sure it's as relevant as it used to be. Maybe there was more, there were more issues. There's more paranoia about it previously. I don't know.
Yeah, the more time that passes, the more of a non-issue it becomes, because all the coins get mixed up, then the older the network becomes. So, but for instance, if I take my coins off an exchange, if you do that, if you have them KYC'd on an exchange and you send them to a certain address, make sure you immediately send them to another address, and thereby you destroy that link, and you can't, the exchange can't give the authorities the information that you bought them at one point and then you spent them at another point, and therefore there's capital gains tax and stuff. If you immediately send them to another address, it's very likely that they don't know that if you still have them or not. So no cap gains tax. Like, so there are so many measures you can take. And also, if I, like you said, if I receive a Bitcoin from you, you can know when I spend it and how much of it I spent. But that requires you to monitor it. So it requires an active participation in spying on me from you. And also, if I immediately send them into CoinJoin, and you cannot know what amount came up the came out the other end. So there are ways of doing this stuff. And the harder we make it for these third parties and the chain anal companies that try to, quote unquote, prove who owns what in Bitcoin, like, we should actively try to make their life hell, because what they're doing is highly immoral and not even proof at all. You cannot, as I said before, you cannot prove that someone doesn't own a Bitcoin. So it's all vaporware. Yeah, I really dislike it.
I'm completely with you. I think the next paragraph also touches on a little bit more of this stuff here. So let's read that one also. So how many privacy measures does the average user need to take? Just as when it comes to storage, it depends on the user's knowledge level. Most users should probably be more careful than they are right now, but there's little reason to be paranoid. It's still very hard to prove that a specific transaction was made by a specific user. The whole ordeal is somewhat akin to the fight against the BitTorrent network 10 years ago. The copyright lobby found different means of scaring off users in different parts of the world, banning websites, prosecuting providers, and so on. But the network itself is still thriving, and torrent files are as accessible as they ever were. A lot of heads will probably have to roll before Bitcoin is accepted everywhere. But just like they couldn't fight file sharing, governments won't be able to fight Bitcoin. Even the policymakers will understand the advantages of Bitcoin usage sooner or later. The word later is key here. If you want to be absolutely sure that what you do with your Bitcoin is legal, private, or worthwhile, just wait. Wait out the storm, and don't use them until they're fully acceptable everywhere. They'll be worth a lot more, and you'll have a lot more options in general. Remember, hodling is using. Yeah, very good. Emphasizes our previous points, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot in this paragraph too. Like the first thing about you should do things on your knowledge that are like in your knowledge level. I think that's a great point. Bitcoin can be a very harsh teacher. If you do something wrong, if you're not careful enough, you can lose your coins. So you shouldn't fiddle around if you don't feel safe fiddling around. That's basically the point I'm making there. And also hodling is using, also important. It's this, I prefer medium of exchange over time and space, as you know, rather than store value. I think the dichotomy is false. Of course, there is the argument that Bitcoins need to be used as a medium of exchange over space for mining to function at all. But they are being used as a medium of time over space. And it's sure, the fees may be low because we're not using it as much as we should. But still, most users could be hodling and the network would be fine. Whereas people tend to forget that the difficulty adjustment algorithm works both ways. And it's not our problem if a specific miner goes out of business. And the only thing that the 10-minute interval and the difficulty adjustment adjusting every 2 weeks, it's still a thing. It doesn't matter. It's just that we're so used to hash rate always going up that we've sort of forgotten that it functions, if not even better, on the way down, because it throws like miners that don't have a sound business model off the market.
Yeah, hodling is using is super important, and I agree. There's a lot of FUD that goes around about how will miners be continually incentivized to keep mining, and I mean it's a difficult one. If you're not moving your Bitcoin around on chain on the network, yeah, of course that's not giving the Bitcoin miners an incentive to keep doing it. But you're not everyone, I guess. Bitcoin is going to have reasons to move around, and more people adopting Bitcoin is very healthy for the network. And I think that's the big thing that's always going to keep this going. And I always come back to also that we're definitely a few more halvings away before the block reward is less than the fees collected on average, where fees will start to really be more important to the profitability of the network, right? I think it's at least two halvings, maybe a third, before that they might start to become in pretty close to equilibrium with each other. And who knows, by then, what's going to happen in 10 years, 12 years? I think Bitcoin adoption is only going to go up. And as Bitcoin adoption goes up, there's only going to be more things that hit the on-chain network. So lots here for sure.
Yeah, and we've had a couple of halvings and Bitcoin is still functioning. The whole FUD about mining and mining not being profitable in the future, that should be in your original calculation when you decide to get the Bitcoin in the first place. That is part of the contract. And if you don't believe in that model, then stay off the network. I mean, it's still not the Bitcoiners' concern how miners make money, and if they're profitable enough in the long run. And the whole notion is very weird because it's set up in the way it is because the thesis is that when fees take over completely, so the block subsidy is so small that it's smaller than the fees in every single block, then adoption will be so large so that won't be a problem. And I certainly believe that. Then you have others, like even Bitcoin developers saying that we need, what's it called, tail emissions, and we need to... At some point change the 21 million cap and we would need to issue more coins and stuff. And I think that would be the absolutely the most detrimental thing to Bitcoin ever. And I don't believe it will ever happen because there is another word for 21 million maximalist, and that is a Bitcoiner. We are in it because we know it's limited in supply. That's why we love it. It's one, I would say most Bitcoiners appreciate that feature of the network more than anything else. The finite nature of the asset is what makes it so compelling. So I don't give a shit about miners and how they make their money. As long as they don't do it by fooling people and selling JPEGs. So I do give a shit, but I don't give a piece of shit about, I do believe that this payout method that we have in the system is working, and it will continue to work. I think the big thing they leave out, the proponents of changing this, is that they think that as long as Bitcoin doubles in value, in purchasing power with each halving, which it has done by far over all the past halvings, it has more than doubled. But as long as it keeps doubling, it's not a problem at all. Because then the miners are getting the same amount of purchasing power per block. So it's not really an issue. I see this as a non-issue.
And they get even more because the fees will also still be increasing in purchasing power, but they'll become a higher and higher portion of each block. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, so the block reward is made up of the block subsidy and the fees. If it doubles in purchasing power, that means it functions as intended. The fee, the subsidy goes down, but it's still worth as much while the fees double in purchasing power. So it is the system functioning exactly as intended.
Absolutely. Yeah, lots here. I think we moved away from the privacy thing a little bit, but in general, I think just the point is keep it simple, stupid. And I think it absolutely applies here, honestly, with Bitcoin. If you learn to not trade, if you learn to not do crazy things with your Bitcoin, I think there's lots of great technological things, and making sure you have a setup that keeps you as private as possible, that's good. But sometimes the simplest things are just the best. Take your Bitcoin into cold storage and don't move it for as long as you can. I think that's the easiest keep it simple, stupid part here.
Yeah. And people who did, are more well off than people who didn't. Now, if you backtrack, go back 10 years, who are the winners there? The monetary maximalist who just hodled through all the storms, or the fiddly around database maximalists that wanted to do interesting things over and over again? And it's obviously the hodlers. And this is a huge part of why these other people that promote other use cases and such things are so eager to do shit and eager to promote this bullshit narratives. Because they never understood Bitcoin as sound money in the first place. So that's why we have this discrepancy opinion, if you will, struggling to find the correct words here. But there is something there that the more you understand Bitcoin as money, the more Bitcoin rewards you for understanding that aspect of it, and the less the counterpoint to that, the opposite is also true. The less you appreciate Bitcoin as money, the more Bitcoin will punish you for not understanding it as money. And this is a very underrated part of any debate about what we should do with Bitcoin.
Oh, very much agree. I think let's end off the chapter here and see if there's any summary points.
Sure.
One of the greatest hidden perks of Bitcoin adoption is that it forces people to think for themselves. First, it forces the user to think about computer security. In order to store your Bitcoins safely, you have to know what you're doing, what software and hardware you can trust, etc. It is virtually impossible to do anything online without trusting any third party. Every piece of hardware and software inside and in between each of the two computers communicating could potentially be corrupt. In Bitcoin, the cautious user will be rewarded, and the reckless user will be punished eventually. This is also true for Bitcoin's on and off ramps, and the less cautious user is always more likely to end up in legal trouble. The coming tsunami that is hyper-Bitcoinization is scary, but a skilled surfer can expect the ride of his lifetime. All right. So this summary paragraph is a little less of a summary, more of a kind of ending point to this aside about privacy and adoption and hodling and all this. And so we can get back to the original point here before we close. But interesting. And I think it just reinforces the exact thing we were talking about. You need to take responsibility for yourself, a common theme that comes up in all of our books, basically.
Yeah, and it's about this. I tweeted about this yesterday, I think. If you would have listened to Bitcoin, toxic Bitcoin maximalists, instead of all the other types of people you could have listened to, like traders and influencers and whatnot, shitcoiners, shitcoin apologists, Bitcoin first companies, all of this other stuff, then you would have had more. If you had listened to the Bitcoin maximalists instead, you would have had more money, more security, more privacy, and more sovereignty than if you had listened to anyone else. And that will be true for the coming 10 years too. Because Bitcoin maximalists, all we do is warn people about bullshit. That is our only goal. We want people, sure, it pumps our bags. If Bitcoin purchasing power goes up and if Bitcoin continues to function, we will be rewarded for it. So we do have an incentive to do so. But the incentive we have is to tell people to not trust but verify. The incentive we have is to keep the network decentralized so it functions over time. The incentive we have is all based on honest stuff, which is not true for any of the other quote-unquote influencers. So be very careful out there. Don't trust verify, but if you need to trust, at least trust the people that tell you to not trust. to don't trust but verify. That's the gist of it.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's a little bit of a meta thing here for us. I think everything that we advocate for and the discussions that we try to create and all this, it's about amplifying the voices that say, hey, yeah, take your Bitcoin into cold storage, take responsibility for it yourself, and try to advocate for Bitcoin in ways that help it succeed and help bring other people to the network, conviction deepening something like this. And yeah, it's a great thing that getting people to take responsibility for their money and for everything around that. We haven't seen the full effects of that yet. Absolutely not. And coming back to the kind of Bitcoin as life thing, like this organism, this form of life that's been injected into the world, I'm certainly excited to see what happens within our lifetimes, because whatever is after that is, well, we can't experience that, at least. But yeah, everything that is going to happen because Bitcoin came into the world and is changing the world for the better. I'm certainly no advocate for change for the sake of change. Change always happens. The world is not in isolation. There's always a trend towards, things disintegrating and order becoming chaos again, that sort of thing. But Bitcoin is a really positive change so far, and I believe that this if Bitcoin can be considered a mind parasite to some extent, it's a very good mind parasite. If it's nothing more than, it might not be more than that, right? Like it's a mind meme in the minds of all the Bitcoin users. It's supported by this technological layer, but in the end, it's in everyone's minds, and it's changing the minds of humanity. It's my turn to go ultra deep here. That was my Knut impression, something like that.
It's beautiful. No, it's absolutely beautiful. And the bigger this thing becomes, and the more attention it gets, the more it attracts noise. So it's very hard to find the signal in the noise. Like the purists are, the growth of the purists is slower than the growth of the charlatans. So the higher Bitcoin's purchasing power, the more scammers you have. And the latest fad is sort of these companies that put quote unquote Bitcoin on the balance sheet, and you're supposed to buy their stock because if you do so, you get exposure to Bitcoin. Paper Bitcoin is not Bitcoin. Take them off of your off the exchange, hold your own private keys, run your node, do all the things. Otherwise, there's no point to any of this. So yeah, with that, I think we're done with Bitcoin as a life form chapter thingy here.
I believe we are. And so I think with that, first of all, let's thank our sponsors here. First of all, Plan B Network. If you're interested in more interesting Bitcoin education resources, not quite exactly like this one, but maybe a little more accessible and differently formatted, go to planb.network and check out everything they have going on there. You can actually enroll in a couple of full-fledged courses. There's a business course going on right now. They have a developer course. They've got plenty of other fantastic things, but they also have tons of free educational resources that are being translated into tons of different languages also. And it's really a great place to point new coiners, your friends, people who are just getting interested in Bitcoin, and also to Bitcoiners, if you want to really dig deep into many of the important topics as well. There's something for everyone, and I'm really glad that the Bitcoin Infinity Academy is a part of Plan B Network.
Absolutely. I agree with all of the above points. It's great to be collaborating with Plan B Network, and we hope to keep this collaboration going far into the future. We have a lot to do there. They have sort of taught us that we're educators, haven't they, Luke?
Exactly. That's a funny realization, but I guess that is what we're doing. We're on the conviction deepening side of the education, but we are absolutely on the side of the education.
Yeah. There are many other good educational resources out there. I'd like to personally just recommend Matthew Crader's Bitcoin University. I really like that channel. So that's a shout out. But yeah, we have other things to recommend too, especially the Bitbox. That's our favorite hardware wallet. It's a small, convenient device that looks like a USB stick, and that it has all the good features a Bitcoin hardware wallet should have. It's easy to use, easy to access, but still very private and secure. So check out the Bitbox, Swiss made super hardware wallet.
Yeah, if you're taking your coins off of the exchange, the Bitbox is absolutely our recommended way to do so. So thank you as well to Bitbox for supporting our efforts with the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. And I think it's also worth mentioning here that we've just released the Praxeology book, the new edition of Praxeology, The Invisible Hand That Feeds You. It's available now on BitcoinInfinityStore.com, as well as on Amazon if you prefer getting it that way. But I've had a lot of fun reworking it with you, Knut. It's still absolutely your book. It's not like Clown World where we wrote it together, but I had great fun going through that with you and getting the new edition out. So from my part, I say go check that out. It's a great introduction to Austrian economics, human action, and as in other words, praxeology.
Yes, that it's my most ambitious work yet, and I'm super proud of it. And I hope this will become a go-to first book for Bitcoiners who want to learn about human action and Austrian economics.
Fantastic. And I think the last thing to mention is also, if you want to get involved with the Academy, go to our Geyser page, geyser.fund/project/infinity, and you can get all the details about how to join the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. You can follow along with our content on YouTube, Rumble, all the video platforms, the podcast platforms. You can read the chapters for free on Nostr. So that's all free. That's all available for everyone. But if you want to get more involved and if you want to support what we're doing, join the Academy. We've got plenty of perks, including for our Mithril Adamantium members, signed copies of all of the books that we cover and access to all of the courses we have here, as well as some t-shirts and other fun perks like regular calls. So check that out and you can see all the details there. Every little bit helps and we really appreciate the support. And honestly, we're looking to build a community. That's really the part of the point here is building a community around these ideas and amplifying the good signal and getting these ideas more and more out there. So anything to add on that, Knut?
No, not really. Use code Infinity everywhere on the internet. If you're buying conference tickets or hardware wallets or whatever you're doing, try code Infinity and see if it works. And remember to keep your chin up and brush your teeth.
And with that, this has been the Bitcoin Infinity Academy. Thank you for listening.
Bye-bye.